Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
We spend a third of our lives sleeping, so my goal is tonight to give you sort of a theoretical understanding of how complex and important a process that is, and hopefully you'll leave tonight knowing how you can improve your own personal sleep and sleep habits. First of all, I wanted to thank some people who've really been quite helpful in helping me understand this important area. Dr. David Klayman is the head of the UCSF Sleep Clinic, and so I actually went and spent some time with him in clinic as he was dealing with the sleep patients that he helps. Dr. Andy Goldberg is an ENT, an ear, nose, and throat physician here at UC who does a lot of the surgery for problems with snoring and sleep apnea. Dr. Richard Schwab is a wonderful sleep specialist at the University of Pennsylvania who loaned me some slides, and finally the Sleep Medicine Educational Institute as well. So what is sleep? I think we all sort of intuitively know it's when we sort of get to bed and try and relax, but it's actually a very complex and active process that's highly regulated and controlled, and it really involves the entire body, but particularly the mind. And it's essential for normal function. We're going to see pretty soon some of the devastating side effects if people don't sleep consistently well. But it's the technical definition, I like this, is reversible behavioral state of perceptual disengagement from and unresponsiveness to the environment. That's academic medical ease if there ever was stuff. So let me talk to you a little bit and walk you through this first slide. And most of you know circadian means rhythms based on the 24-hour clock. And it is, we have a deep place in our brain that they think is the sort of center of our circadian clock that helps us get awake at the right times, fall asleep at the right times. And it's a fairly complicated and intertwined process. So let me... Here we are in a 24-hour day, and we're waking ourselves up, and then we're going to go to sleep, and then we're waking ourselves up, etc. And you can see that there are two things here that are very tightly coordinated. We're going to talk in a little while about melatonin, but our body actually makes a hormone in the pineal gland, mostly in response to light and dark, that rises and falls and is inhibited by light during the day. But then when it's dark at night, it starts to get secreted, and that allows us to get ready for sleep and to fall asleep. And you may not notice it. This is not a very broad temperature range, but our temperature tends to drop at just before we're going to go to sleep. And all of these things, you can see, are very tightly coordinated. Now, this looks pretty complicated, so let me walk you through it. About 40, 50 years ago, people discovered that when they put these electrodes on people's brains, that they could pick up certain patterns of brain wave activity, electrical activity. And then years later, they figured out when they did this with people as they were sleeping, and they saw that there was this very consistent pattern where the brain waves changed throughout the night. So when we're in an awake state, this is the pattern. And then there are four stages which go progressively more deep into a very, very deep sleep, and that's stage four. And it's not important that you memorize what these look like, but for the sleep specialist who's doing a study in a lab and has their patients wired up, these waves are very important to be able to mark, is this person sort of walking through or sleeping through the night in the way that most people do? So this is a typical, what's called a somnogram or a polysomnogram pattern. So let me show you. So we're awake at first, and then we deeply go into sleep, finally stage four. And throughout the night, we kind of do this up and down, up and down. And you can see it sort of gets progressively a little bit more shallow through the morning. These are spikes where people may actually get wake up momentarily. Now, so this is deep, deep sleep. And what happens in that, our body can move, but our mind is very still. And this is the time that we think you're learning, you're consolidating the things of the day. It's a very important phase of sleep. As you get to this lighter sleep, most of you, have you heard of the term REM sleep? So it means rapid eye movement sleep. So it's fascinating. It's the time when we're dreaming. So what does the body do? It's literally almost paralyzed. So when we're dreaming, our body, our mind won't allow our body to move, but our eyes are absolutely rapidly moving. And this was a huge discovery about 30 years ago by Dr. William Dement down at Stanford. He's sort of the grandfather of sleep medicine. And they found, so the REM periods are these little areas marked in green. So if you were to be awakened by somebody during this time, you'd probably have pretty complete recall of your dreams. And I have some patients who say, I don't ever dream, never, ever. We all dream. The issue is, can you remember it? So if you were awakened way, way down here in this deep stage four sleep, you're not going to be in the process of a dream. And first of all, you're going to be groggy getting up, and you won't remember anything. But if people can, you know, get waked up in the middle of these REM episodes, their recall for what they're dreaming is pretty good. Now, it usually takes about 90 minutes to get to this first cycle, and then the cycles get a little bit shorter throughout the night. So this is a young, healthy adult, but look, and then this is also a young, healthy adult, and we've just put the graph in a slightly different way. What we've done is we've marked the REM periods in black, but you can see they kind of come closer together. And the first phase of sleep is usually the one that, you know, you go the deepest, then you come to REM, and then it's through the night, as I said. And about a quarter or a fifth of the night is spent in REM sleep, and it's really important. We don't understand exactly what, but when people are REM deficient, they're in sleep labs. Somebody does these awful experiments where they, like, wake people up the minute they get into REM sleep. They're not happy people. You really need both the deep sleep and the REM periods to be functioning normally. And as I said, you have progressively more of these dreaming or REM episodes as the night progresses. This usual beginning cycle is about 90 minutes. And I mentioned already that when we're dreaming, our bodies are pretty much not moving, versus in deep delta wave sleep, our bodies actually can move, but our mind is a little bit more quiet. So unfortunately, we don't sleep like babies anymore. Have you noticed? So babies are virtual sleep machines. Anybody who's got a grandchild or raised a child, except of course when you're trying to get to sleep yourself, but most of the time the deep, deep sleep that a child gets is reflected, because you need a lot of sleep when you're growing. So in this area, we have, this is the REM sleep, this is stage two, and then this is the stage three and four, the very deep sleep. So if you're like an infant, you're sleeping, you know, 12 hours a day, a lot of it's into this deep sleep stage, and you're not very awake. But unfortunately, as we age, our sleep gets changed. You know, many of us, I'm like 63 right now, so according to this picture, I'm probably not getting as much restorative sleep, the stage three and four, that I did certainly when I was younger. Teens are really amazing because they're burning the candle at both ends. They need much more sleep than we do. And in almost every survey, there are only 20% of them are getting anywhere near the amount that they need. So here's another way for us to look at how our sleep patterns change with aging. This looks pretty similar to the first graph I showed you, didn't it, with a sort of nice, smooth progression through the night. This is what an older person's sleep pattern looks like. So it's less restored. I mean, you can see there's a lot more sort of shallow areas. There's more evening, mid-evening awakenings. Even the REM periods are sort of not in quite as coordinated a way. So we do definitely get progressively less delta or deep sleep as we age. And I'm not really sure what the reason is completely, but it's universally noted when people are in sleep labs. So I'd like to define, because we're going to focus today mostly on two major sleep disorders, insomnia and sleep apnea or snoring. But that's not, so I want to get clear the terms so you know what we're talking about. And insomnia is not the same as sleep deprivation. So sleep deprivation means you're just burning the candle at both ends. But if you are given the opportunity to sleep, you have no problem sleeping. So those are probably very many of us in the audience. But certainly at a high-risk populations are teens, parents, night shift workers, flight crews, healthcare workers, truck drivers, anybody who's having to struggle with not having enough time for sleep. But they don't have an inherent difficulty sleeping if they've given, you know, the opportunity. That's different from an insomniac. So somebody who suffers from insomnia could have a lovely bedroom, all the opportunity in the world, and they're going to be lying there like this, either not able to get to sleep initially, not able to stay asleep, waking up too early, or more importantly, waking up feeling tired and groggy. Now, there's a huge overlap, because clearly some shift workers, when they come back from a very busy day at work, who might not normally have problems sleeping, might have a night or two of insomnia because they just can't relax. So there's really a fair amount of overlap, and both of them contribute to what I'll talk about in a second, which is a fairly significant national sleep debt. I like this cartoon. Man, this brings back memories, Mike. I remember moving into the residence at the University of Tennessee. Ha! First month we were there, all we did was party. Guess it was the rush of freedom, you know, being away from home. Then it just hit us. This was the university. I realized we had serious work to do, and we couldn't waste any time. So you cut out the partying? No, we cut out sleep. And I don't know about you, but in college, I really didn't sleep anywhere near as much as I needed to. But it's not just college students. Our world is really now a 24-hour world, and we've got cell phones, internet, Blackberries. Everything is impinging upon our ability to sort of be quiet and have some space in which to sleep. So the national sleep debt. I thought you'd enjoy this picture, but let me go through it. So Americans slept, our grandparents slept 9 to 10 hours a night at the turn of the century. Makes sense. Most of them were farmers. They were working really hard. They were exhausted after a long day of physical labor. And until the late 1800s, there was no electrical light. So their cycles very much went in with the natural light and dark cycles. Now, they estimate that most adults need between 8 and 8.5 hours of sleep. So I'm just curious, how many of you consistently get 8.5 hours of sleep? Well, some of you, okay. How many of you don't? Okay, all right. And now, on average, American adults probably sleep less than 7 hours a night. And many people sleep a whole lot less during the week and try and make up for it on average on the weekend. And when Bill Clinton was president, he was very proud and known for sleeping literally only 5 to 6 hours a night. And this is what happens. You know, did any of you see this? This was on the news. It was the Martin Luther King Day, and he was behind this wonderful speaker. And then the headline was, "I had a dream." Oh. But, you know, I'm going to say something positive, because he's able to sleep. I mean, he was probably, after sleeping for 5 to 6 hours a night, he probably had a fairly significant sleep debt. And one of the things that helps people who are that active is taking, you know, naps on a regular basis. So it certainly didn't prevent him from doing it here. So what happens when you don't get enough sleep? And this really surprised me. I mean, I know you wake up feeling kind of groggy and worse, a little irritable, and you're not focused so well. But there are real physiological dangers to consistently not getting enough sleep. First of all, we're much less productive at work and at school. This I'm going to spend a little bit of time on. Sleeping, driving, sleeping, sleepy. It's really, really dangerous. Clearly, we don't perform as well on cognitive tasks. This is an amazing one. We have just recently found out that during sleep, your body makes certain hormones that allow your appetite and all of the other things that keep you a healthy weight to happen. So when you're sleep deprived, you make all the wrong kinds of hormones, and you have more appetite, and you tend to put on weight. And they even did a study recently where they had somebody in one of the sleep labs, and remember down at the peak when you have that nice deep sleep? What they did was they buzzed these patients while they were sleeping, not enough to wake them, but they buzzed them so that they kind of got out of that deep sleep and started up again, and every single one of them, sugar was out of whack after just 2 or 3 nights of doing that. So it has profound effects on a very common problem in our society today, which is being overweight, obese, or glucose intolerant. We also, they've done studies, when you're sleep deprived, you feel pain more intensely. So if you've got a chronic rheumatological disease or you've got chronic back pain, the best thing you can do, one of the good things you can do, is get a good night's sleep. They've actually shown that people who are chronic insomnia sufferers have an increased risk of having some sort of psychiatric or mental disorder. People in general describe their quality of life as less, poor general health, certainly increased healthcare costs, and it looks like probably all of these are adding together to increased mortality. So here's just one graph, and in red are all the insomniacs, and in yellow are the ones that say they sleep okay. So this is number of times, so this is about a 50%, 100% more visits to the physicians or nurses. About 50% more medication prescriptions are written. They're twice as likely to miss work, be much less productive at work, and then there's even a risk of people then using substances such as alcohol. So not getting enough sleep is more than just waking up a little bit tired the next morning. And this is one of the hugest dangers. And when I heard Dr. Dement speak recently at a conference, he is a passionate advocate of people not driving sleepy. And the reason is there are 100,000 automobile accidents yearly that are attributed to driving at the wheel when you're sleepy. And this involves over 1,000 deaths and a lot of money in terms of diminished productivity. And they've done studies to show that just 24 hours of sleep deprivation, you're as cognitively impaired and motor impaired as if you were legally drunk. And the thing is, when you get into the car, you're not even thinking it. Oh, I'm just a little sleepy, you know. But more important is that you're going to be driving on the freeway with other people that are sleep deprived. So it's not just listening, you know, talking on the cell phone. It's that you just don't have the same responses that you would have if you had a good night's sleep. And over a third of people, has anybody here ever fallen asleep at the wheel? I have. It's awful. I mean, I came back. It was residency. I was an intern. It was, 30 hours on, and this had been month 7. And I was coming back from San Francisco General, an ER shift, and I, by the grace of God, just at the last minute, could feel the car swerving to the right, and it just scared me. I mean, it's just amazing, because we see these residents and interns and people who are just working long hours. Even with now an 80-hour-a-week limitation, it's still dangerous, I think, after a shift, to get behind the wheel to get home. 13% of drivers doze off once a month, and teens are particularly at risk. Over half of all of the fall asleep accidents are when teens are driving, and this is scary if you're ever on the freeway with a lot of big truckers. Canadian and American long-haul truckers get fewer than 5 hours of sleep a night. So it's actually Dr. Dement teaches a course at Stanford on sleep and dreams, and he said the one thing that he feels that he does every year by talking to medical students and to undergraduates is in convincing them that if they start to really feel sleepy, to pull over to the side and take a nap or to get somebody else to help them drive. So there's over 100 different sleep disorders. And it was really complicated when I first started trying to research this to try and figure out how to bunch them together in a way that would make sense. So I'm going to do it in four groups, but we're going to focus mostly on insomnia. We already talked a little bit about sleep deprivation. And then problems with sort of staying awake, there's a huge long list, and one of the major ones is sleep apnea, which we'll spend some time on. And then this last one is kind of rare, but we'll touch base on it in the end. So we're going to focus now mostly for the next 10 or 15 minutes on insomnia. And look at this. Only 2% of people asked said they never had a problem with insomnia. And I think that's probably true in terms of my clinical experience. Over half say they have significant problems at least a couple of nights a week and maybe even every night. And this is a huge number of people who have insomnia. And the sad part is that unless it's really a problem, most of them just have gotten used to it, assume it's the way they're going to be, and they never bring it up with their healthcare practitioner. And as I mentioned before, insomnia is a repeated difficulty getting to sleep, waking up too early, staying asleep, and feeling unrefreshed. And I like the fact that they call this a 24-hour problem because you wake up not functioning well, so this is not just a problem of tossing and turning at night. You're really impacted through your entire day. And the thing that bothers most insomniacs is waking up feeling really drowsy or tired. But every single one of the rest of these is also a problem for them. What I like about this slide is that it shows how complicated and multifactorial it is to develop the problem of insomnia. So we're going to. So any one of you, I'm sure, you know, you've gotten a bad piece of news, or there's something going wrong with your family, or you're agitated about something. Most of us have had at least one or two tossing and turning nights. What is good is most of us, once that stress relaxes a little bit or goes away or we start to deal with it better, get back to our normal sleep patterns. But there's some people for whom this then becomes a chronic problem. I'm going to talk a little bit about the fact that almost every medical and neurological condition that I see in my practice has the opportunity to create insomnia and also be worsened by it. Also true of mental disorders, true of lots of the medications you and I are taking or I'm prescribing. Some of them have effects on the sleep cycle. And then all of these sort of funnel into these behavioral and conditioning factors. Most of the time people with insomnia have a little bit of this sort of tension when they go to bed. And we'll talk a little bit about some more details. So I say here it's most often a two-way street because every one of these physical problems, heart disease, stroke, lung disease, kidney disease, Parkinson's, dementia, GI problems, all can contribute to making sleep more difficult. And then if you're having problems sleeping, it makes the condition more difficult. So it's really this ongoing two-way street, this cycle back and forth. The same is true if you've got any kind of psychiatric problems. Although most insomniacs, 60%, don't report having major depression or anxiety, a significant percentage do. And then finally, any medicine that crosses the blood-brain barrier, and that's a whole bunch, including ones that are prescription and some that we can take over the counter, can affect the sleep. So the non-prescription ones that many people use, alcohol, both acutely and then if you're withdrawing from it, caffeine, nicotine, just over-the-counter decongestants when you have a cold, and then certainly recreational drugs that are considered uppers. Now, of the prescription drugs that I might write in my practice, many of the antidepressants can have effect on sleep. Steroids, these are called beta blockers, used for heart disease and hypertension. Statins used for cholesterol, other kinds of stimulants, and then Parkinson drugs. So a huge list of medications. When you look, when you get your medication from Walgreens or Long's and you look at the side effect profile, often sleep disturbance is listed. So let's go through a case that's very common. And this is Bill, a patient in my practice who ever since he got laid off 4 months ago has had trouble falling asleep. He now keeps the TV on at night to sort of help him feel distracted, and he gets more and more anxious when he gets into bed every night because he knows he's just going to be tossing and turning for the next 2 hours. And he does. He goes to bed around 11, but he really doesn't get to sleep until 1 o'clock or even later. He gets up once during about 2 in the morning to go to the bathroom, and he wakes up in the morning at normal time but really feeling unrefreshed. Then to catch up, he's sort of napping at work. He takes 2 glasses of wine at dinner to sort of unwind a little bit, and then he really needs 2 double lattes in the morning to function. Does this sound like anybody that you know or in your family? And it's actually his physical exam is completely normal. So this is the sort of schematic that sort of I alluded to earlier about how a chronic insomnia problem develops. So this means premorbid. I hate that term, but this is like normally. This is the way you would be when you're sleeping normally. And this is what you'd have to get to have insomnia. So he had this very bad acute stress. He got laid off from work. And most of the rest of us, as I said, as the stress would come down, we'd go back to sleep and back to our normal patterns. But he started to ruminate about it. And so he started to get very, very, oh, I can't sleep, I'm not going to get to bed, and then I'll be too tired. And now it's a chronic situation because even though the stress is down, all of that behavioral stuff is keeping him above this threshold. So that's going to have implications for when we talk about how to deal with insomnia because there are lots and lots of things we can do to help eliminate this green part of the curve and get Bill down to sleeping again. So I just want to say there are many other causes to sleep problems than the insomnia that Bill has. So I just want to tell you that we're going to be going over these later on in the lecture, but we never forget to think about, could he have sleep apnea? And I'll define that in a second. Could he have these strange leg movements in the middle of the night? And we'll go over those at the end of the lecture. So when Bill finally came and started to tell me that he was not sleeping well, my job as his primary care doctor is to really do a comprehensive medical history, because sleep disturbances occur with some medical conditions, and I don't want to be just saying, oh, you've got insomnia. I really want to think clearly, is his sleep disturbance really something that I need to be aware of for a new medical condition? But then there's a specific sleep history, and what's really nice is in your packet, Dr. Klayman let me recopy for you the sleep questionnaire that they use in the sleep center. And many of these questions are on it. Do you have trouble getting to sleep, staying asleep, or waking up too early? Those were the definitions. Do you feel tired during the day? How often has this been a problem? How long has it been going on? Has this ever happened to you before? What does your bed partner notice? Tell me some things you think your bed partner might notice. Snoring. Oh, my God. Snoring, stopping breathing. And people who live alone don't have, unless their neighbors can hear. Actually, I had a neighbor once in an apartment next, and I was a medical student, and I risked being so invasive. And I said, you know, I'm hearing you stopping breathing at night. You know, I slipped the thing under the door so that hopefully they didn't identify that it was the neighbor on the right, because that's something that's really going to have serious health consequences. So having a sleep partner is actually not only nice for other reasons, but it's very nice because you get some feedback about what your sleep cycle is like. What have you tried to take? What are your lifestyle issues? And this last one I think is really important. Have you ever fallen asleep at the wheel? Usually I don't jump right to a sleep diary, but those can also be very helpful. It's interesting. People with insomnia are not good predictors of how much they're actually sleeping. And those of us who aren't insomniacs also aren't good. So some people, like Bill, who's gotten so focused on the fact that he's not sleeping, underestimates how much sleep he's getting. And then when they've sent normal people to the sleep lab, they're not sleeping as much as they think they are. So it's interesting, but still the physician or the nurse practitioner should take a detailed sleep history. Now, this is one sleep scale that's included in the UCSF. It's embedded in that questionnaire, but it's like, how sleepy are you? How often when you're just sitting and reading would you fall asleep, or when you're watching TV? So you add these up, and normally your score should be less than 10. So sleep medicine. This was in 2004, Time Magazine started to make people aware that there's really a whole science understanding about sleep. And in 1970, Dr. Dement opened the very first sleep center at Stanford. And sleep studies are now performed in these sort of separate centers, but increasingly people are wired up, and I'll show you how they're wired, and allowed to do sleep studies at home. In a sleep lab, you go at 8 o'clock, you know, this is not even close to how you're wired for sound. This is more a home study. So you've got all of these electrodes here. You've got electrodes around your eyes because they want to be able to diagnose when you're having your REM periods. They have a belt around your chest so they know how you're breathing. EKG, they have something on your arm so they can tell whether you're tossing and turning. And then finally, just a thing to measure how much oxygen you're getting to in your system. And so, I mean, if you have insomnia as a problem and you're sleeping in a strange thing and this sleep technician is staring at you, I mean, I can't imagine that anybody gets to sleep, but they do evidently, and if they don't, they suffer the night, you know. So the home studies, which is nice now, is that they usually don't do these two things, the EEG and the eye movements, but they'll often, the home study has these elements. So a patient will come at bedtime and get kind of wired and then go home, and it's actually in some ways much easier for them because it's their familiar bed. So then as a result of what, so they get, if you do the formal sleep study, it's usually a full night, and that you get this pattern, and then you may get some information. And you'll hear more what the pattern looks like with the sleep apnea in, when I finish with that. So here's just a step thing about how you would deal, how physicians or clinicians deal with managing insomnia. So the first thing is basically discussing this with your provider, and then finally getting the diagnosis, which in the case of insomnia is really mostly not requiring a sleep study. It's mostly the history, a little bit physical exam. And then we're going to spend a fair amount of time on what we call sleep hygiene or the educational, behavioral, and cognitive interventions. This should always, always, always be first line, and it's often not taught or not emphasized. So basically, there are some things you can do to educate yourself and change some of your behaviors, which may not be helping you get a good night's sleep. And then finally, if those aren't helpful, you can work with somebody who's trained in helping you reformat some of the associations you have, like Bill, you know, I'm wired and I'm not going to get a good night's sleep. So some of those principles of what we call sleep hygiene are this: keep a regular bedtime and wake-up time. And like most of my patients go, are you kidding? Am I not going to sleep in on a Saturday morning? You've got to be nuts. But if you've got a chronic insomnia problem, it really helps to set a time when you go to bed that's the same weekday or weekend and getting up at the same time. It just helps your system get into a regular cycle. Exercise is a great tension reducer, good for the heart, good for many other reasons, but usually they don't recommend, you know, running a mile and then trying to get into bed. So try not to be exercising right before bedtime, but certainly regular exercise in the morning or the afternoon is great. This light exposure is really important. We've lost it, and I'll have a slide in a second about what we call now light pollution. But because remember you saw the melatonin is suppressed when I'm in the sunlight, which is great because I don't want to be sleeping in the middle of the day. And then it starts to be increasingly synthesized and secreted when it goes dark. So if you're in an environment where the TV's blaring, you've got lights all on, you're reading at night, you've got all of this stimulation, but particularly light, you may not be helping your system do its natural thing and let the melatonin start to increase and help you fall asleep. Most of us like to snack at night, but a heavy, heavy meal right before you go to bed is usually not a good idea. Certainly, we're going to talk a little bit about caffeine, alcohol, and nicotine's just bad on all accounts. And then how do you keep your sleep environment? You want a temperature that's probably a little bit on the cooler side, but whatever is comfortable for you. Dark, quiet, something that's not got a lot of noise distracting you. And this is the hardest one, I think. They call it using the bed only for sleeping and sex. Because everybody says, well, I love to watch the TV in bed, or that's where the TV is, or, oh, how can I not read my novel and fall asleep? But if somebody's got chronic, and if you have no trouble sleeping with that, hallelujah. But if you're sitting there in bed, you know, for 2 hours like Bill, then you should not be lying in bed, because then you associate being in bed with not being able to sleep. So the rule, the recommendation is usually if it's 20 or 25 minutes and you're not sound asleep and you're doing this and you're looking at your clock, get up, go out, read, do whatever, do some nice quiet activity, and then when you're ready and you feel sleepy, come back and go to bed. And also practice a relaxing routine. That means, you know, a warm bath, the warm milk, whatever works for you, but not doing lots of work on the internet up until like a minute before you're ready to crash. So caffeine, I added a little bit to this slide from what's in your thing, but I wanted to just, 80 to 90% of us consume it every day, and it's definitely a central nervous system stimulus. And one thing I just wanted to make clear is that there's some hidden sources. We think of coffee as the major source, and indeed, you know, a regular cup of drip coffee has about 135 milligrams. Tea, anywhere a little bit less than half, depending on the brand. Cola drinks, some of those have double, triple the amount of caffeine. Chocolate, fortunately, has less, especially dark chocolate. But look at this. There's some combination over-the-counter medicines that you might not be aware have caffeine as part of them. And those include Excedrin, Anacin, Midol. And I just wanted to show you no dose, you know, that sometimes people will take to stay awake has a whopping dose of 200 milligrams of caffeine. Now, I was just going to show you, this is a picture of a spider web, and this is the spider web with the spider off of caffeine, and this is the spider web that she or he wove when they gave him caffeine for the first time. This is like, what is your brain on drugs like? This was, I thought that was fascinating. Anyway, so alcohol. Boy, how many of us have that drink, that glass of wine, or that one cocktail to just kind of chill and get to sleep? And it is a relaxant initially, but it really wreaks havoc with the whole sleep architecture. So it causes more frequent awakenings, sort of fragmented sleep, less restful sleep. So if you must have alcohol, and this is a little hard if you're having a late dinner and you want that glass of wine, you shouldn't really have it within 3 hours of actually trying to fall asleep. Certainly you don't want to be mixing alcohol with other sleep medications because of the capacity for a double hit and over-sedation. And certainly it's even more dangerous in people who might have breathing disorders such as sleep apnea, which again we're going to get to in a second, or elderly people who don't have the balance that they might have and tend to fall. So this is the light pollution I was talking about. And the electric light bulb was invented in the late 1800s, and up to that time, basically, we had candles and some gas lights, but most people went to bed when the sun went down and got up when the sun came up. And even in the 1950s, 70% of rural households in the United States did not have electricity. So we've really changed to make this a 24-hour light-filled world. And this is a composite sort of map of the United States showing all of the light areas. And you can see certainly along the Northeast Corridor, here San Francisco, you know, there's the nice Rocky Mountains, which are kind of dark. And there's now a whole new International Dark Sky Association that's really trying to cut back unnecessary night light. And, you know, I noticed it, two ways in which I noticed it. I was totally unaware of the impact that this had. I've been staying with my sister who lives in Northern Marin while my house is being worked on, and I sleep like a log every time in her house, even though the bed isn't mine and it's not as nice a room. And I realized after a while, she lives in an area that have no street lights. There is absolutely no ambient light, and the room is dark. So I all of a sudden put that together, and then I went on a long backpacking trip, 3 weeks backpacking trip, where you really are only going to sleep because you only have your flashlight. And the hardest adjustment I had coming back was not being able to see the stars and realizing that there was so much light that I was, like, confused. My rhythms were not entrained in the same way they were with the backpacking trip. So some people are more sensitive than others. There are some people who believe that even a watch, a clock that's got a lighted dial, is enough to disrupt some very sensitive people. So if you've got your cell phone, if you've got the night light, turn it so that the lighted thing is the other direction. That way also, if you get up, you're not going to be going, oh, it's 3:05. Oh, it's 3:09. You know, that hardly ever helps you fall asleep. So I always get the question, are naps helpful? And the answer is yes and no. They're probably yes if you're really sleep deprived, as Bill Clinton apparently was, but not if you suffer from chronic insomnia, because the naps, which Bill is doing in the midday, is kind of maybe helping him fall asleep for that short period of time, but it's getting him out of this normal cycle. So there are even people that say, don't nap. Just stay up until you're really sleepy and then hit the bed and fall asleep. But have any of you seen this? There now is a whole industry for people who need to nap on the go. And this is a company that has made this very cushy sleep pod. And I heard that they're available at the international terminal at San Francisco Airport. And you lie in this very comfortable position. They have either white noise or music or nothing or earphones. And you can fall asleep for the tune of $25 for a 20-minute nap. But, you know, it says a lot to me, and this certainly would be appropriate in an airport where people are coming in tired, missed flights and stuff. But they're increasingly in large cities and in other places so that people can literally go and safely nap during the day. So I'm just briefly going to say this was a conference at the National Institutes of Health in 2005 about some of the sleep hygiene things that I talked about. And I think habits are really hard to break. If you're used to going to sleep with lots of noise and the TV going, and it's going to be hard to say, I'm going to turn all of those things off, especially because some of these things take 2 to 10 weeks to really be effective. But this is the best sleep treatment for people who are willing to hang in there. And in some cases, the sleep problem gets worse initially while you've cut all of the other things that you normally do to your, you know, routine out. But it's definitely been demonstrated in randomized controlled trials. It's as effective as sleep medications in many cases. They last beyond, even if you've had treatments, you can often maintain the behaviors. There are no adverse effects. And the sad part is that there are not so many trained therapists to do the sort of cognitive behavioral work that I talked about. But this is good stuff and should really be first line. So now we've talked about diagnosis a little bit, about all these education and behavior things, and now we're going to get down to the pharmacological therapy. So ideally, you'd want a pill. If I wanted to make a whole lot of money, I'd be a drug company that could make a sleep aid that was could help people fall asleep, stay asleep, have complete rest, be happy during the day, no side effects, safe for long-term use. Most of you are aware that a lot of the sleep medications people either become dependent on, they get tolerant to, which means that same 5 milligram dose suddenly 5 weeks later is not doing it, so they need to increase it to 10, or they don't go through symptoms of withdrawal. I've had a number of patients on chronic sleep medications who suddenly go, oh my gosh, I ran out, and they have the worst insomnia. We call it rebound insomnia. And I want something that didn't have abuse potential. That medication does not exist, unfortunately. So what we've had in what physicians and nurses have had to help people with sleep before the 1960s were these very sedating class of drugs called barbiturates, and I'm not going to have time to talk about those. But in the early 1960s, the benzodiazepines, Valiums of the world, came into play. And these were miracle drugs at the time. They really helped people feel less anxious, get to sleep, but they also had a lot of the problems, the side effects that I just sort of alluded to. In the early 1990s, these two, Zolpidem and Zaleplon, were marketed, and maybe you recognize them. The names are Ambien and Sonata. And then early in the 2000s, we've had another one, Lunesta, and then a whole new class of drugs that I'll tell you about, which is a melatonin-like drug. So how do we pharmacologically treat? Well, many people go here first before asking for a prescription. So I already mentioned about how alcohol's not a good sleep medication. Antihistamines. So how many of you have taken Benadryl over the counter for their allergies and then fallen asleep at your desk? Well, guess what? Benadryl's the major ingredient in all the over-the-counter sleep medicines. So it's not that those medicines are being marketed for allergies, but they're being marketed for the side effects. And the problem is many times people will take them and then they'll wake up and really, really be groggy the next day. I'm just briefly going to touch on two herbal medicines, valerian and kava, which are available over the counter, and then we're going to take a little bit more time to talk about melatonin. Then we'll shift over here to talk about the various prescription medications. So as I just said, the major ingredient in Somanex, Sleepies, all of those is either diphenhydramine, which is the same medication in Benadryl, or doxylamine. So just when you look, in fact, it's sometimes cheaper if you just go buy the Benadryl and not buy the Somanex. But the potential adverse effects are some that I mentioned. The residual sedation is probably one of the most major problems. In terms of herbs, basically, valerian is something that is relatively safe, has some efficacy, but nothing close to the prescription medications. It's widely used in Europe. Kava is a ceremonial herb that was used in the South Pacific for the men in society. So this drink would be created with the root of the kava plant. And people, students of mine who have actually traveled to the South Pacific, say that it's actually quite a relaxing drink, and sometimes used in this country to help with sleep, but it's been taken off the market in Europe because of some problems with liver damage. So even though it's still being marketed in this country, it's not something that I would necessarily recommend. And all of these over-the-counter medications are not regulated in the same way that even aspirin and Tylenol are, so you may also have a problem finding a high-quality product. But I want to take a couple minutes for melatonin. How many of you have tried melatonin ever? And how many think it's really helpful? Oh, so some of you, that's great. So this is the same hormone that we make in our brains, in the pineal gland every night. The building block is the amino acid tryptophan, which is why people always think turkey makes you sleepy, because turkey is very rich in tryptophan. And it's released into the circulation in response to the light and dark cycles. So the low levels during the daytime when there's not much being made are between 2 and 10 picograms per milliliter. And at nighttime, you can see it's quite a larger peak, between 100 and 2,000. And most of the time, over-the-counter doses I see when I've gone to Whole Foods or to Long's or Walgreens are between 1 and 10 milligrams. But they actually raise the blood levels to really super physiological levels, to 30 to 60 times what your normal blood level would be. So it's probably a little bit overkill. And in fact, a dose as little as 0.1 to 0.3 milligrams would get your levels to what they would normally be. So it looks like when you're buying, especially if you're taking on the higher end, you're really, really increasing the melatonin higher than it would normally be in your body. And studies show that it's generally safe without risk. You don't get dependent on it or very grogged out in the morning, especially if you're taking doses on the lower side, so less than 5 milligrams. And the reason we're spending so much time with melatonin is because one of the new prescription medications is a super melatonin. So I want you to be aware of what our natural hormone does. So some people in practice, we've used the side effects of medications. So if I treat a depressed patient with a medication like trazodone or one of these, and they come back and they say, God, my depression's better, but I'm just so sleepy, I slept like a log, then people go, ooh, well, maybe I should use this in other patients who might not be depressed for their sleepy effects. Does that make sense? So many of these very sedating antihistamines are used in primary care or in regular medicine just to help people fall asleep. But it's unclear whether or not you're treating, you know, whether you're treating just the insomnia or a little bit of underlying depression. But there are lots of side effects with some of these medications, so you really want to be a little bit careful. Now, I'm not going to go over this in detail because we're going to talk in individual slides about each of these. But these are the medications that are FDA approved. So let me just talk you through what's off-label and what's not. So the Federal Drug Administration, if a drug company makes a product and they want to get an FDA approval, they have to present clinical data for that indication. So, for instance, trazodone manufacturers did not test this for insomnia. But we, as physicians, are still able to prescribe it even if it's off-label. But these are the ones that are specifically designated and FDA approved for sleep. So the benzodiazepines I sort of alluded to earlier, there's some really nice effects of them. They reduce the time it takes to fall asleep. People feel better. They think they're sleeping better. They're not getting up as much, and they're actually sleeping in bed more than they're tossing and turning. But there's some negative side effects that I've alluded to. It actually alters those patterns that we showed in the first couple of slides. So it affects how much REM sleep you're getting. It affects some of those other phases as well. And if you take too much of it, it can actually suppress your breathing. And it can cause people to be a little confused and a little cognitively impaired in the morning. This is very interesting. There are people who have almost total amnesia for a short period of time when they get up. And one cynic was thinking that maybe they've forgotten how bad they slept the night before and that that's why these drugs work so well. They just wake up and they can't remember having been awake. And all of the rest of these things I talked about, dependence, tolerance, and rebound. And these are listed as well. You really, really want to be, we have always wanted to be very careful in elderly, debilitated patients, people who tend to fall easily. And particularly if I'm worried about somebody with sleep apnea, I don't want to suppress their breathing anymore until I get them appropriately treated. And unfortunately, most of you probably recognize Heath Ledger's picture here and the tragic accidental death that he had from unintentionally combining a bunch of medications. And that I pulled up the toxicology report tonight just before coming. He had 6 prescription medications in his system, 2 strong pain medications, 3 different benzodiazepines, and an over-the-counter antihistamine. So, you know, I think he, I have no idea why, but it was it was designated an accidental polypharmacy tragedy. So it really is important not to be taking multiple things for the same purpose. So what are these? So I wanted to show you, remember I said there are these newer generations? Those are what are called benzodiazepine receptor agonists. So there's not going to be a quiz about this, but they're a little bit different from the first generation Valiums, and this is how they're a little bit different. They all respond to a receptor called the GABA receptor. GABA is gamma-aminobutyric acid, and it's one of the neurotransmitters that's the most sedating and calming in the system. Well, it ends up that the GABA receptor in the brain is very, very complicated, so some drugs come and stimulate it in some ways and other drugs in other ways. So these new generations don't have quite the same profile. They don't relax people the same much as much. They don't disrupt the REM sleep as much, and it's believed that there's less abuse potential and less CNS side effects. And these are the new, these BZRAs, the Zaleplon, the Zolpidem, and I have trouble pronouncing this, Escitalopram. Now, the only thing that distinguishes them, so this is nice, when it says maintain sleep architecture, that means it doesn't upset that nice pattern that I showed you earlier, and proven to improve the fact that people can get to sleep sooner, that's great. Most of these are short, these two are short-term, although this is now available in a longer-term formulation. And this one, the Lunesta, was shown to be safe, at least in the clinical trials, for up to 6 months. So it has an FDA approval for longer-term use. So there were some really interesting warnings in the last couple of months, and I don't know if any of you saw them, but there are some strange behaviors in people that are taking sleeping medications. It's rare, but they're there. There was one woman who kept gaining weight, and her husband's going, "What, honey? You hardly eat during the day." And they finally videotaped her, and she was getting up and almost in a sleepwalking way, going to the refrigerator, eating, and going to bed and having absolutely no memory of it. And the worst, there are people who got in their cars and drove and had no memory what they were doing. So this is the new kid on the block, and what makes it different is that it's a whole new class of sleeping medication. This is a pharmaceutical melatonin-like drug that's 17 times more powerful than our native body form of melatonin. And it was approved in 2005 for just difficulty falling asleep. And what's nice about this is it's not a controlled substance. So because they feel there's no problem with dependence or tolerance or whatever, physicians can write it on a regular prescription, and it's approved for long-term use. And you can see, here's the native structure of melatonin, and this is the drug structure. So you could understand how it would be possibly acting in the same way in the brain. The most common side effects of this are the same ones, actually, that are true of almost any of the other sleep medications. And you do have to be careful. There are some people with liver disease who are taking certain other medications with depression or with high levels of this hormone shouldn't probably be taking it. So this was also, let me just review for you how the NIH ran through all these different classes of medications and what their recommendations were. So these new generation drugs, these BZRAs, they feel are effective in short-term management of insomnia. And they feel that the actual side effects are less than the old class of benzodiazepines, mostly because they have short half-lives, so they get in and out of the system more quickly. Most of them should be for only short-term use, with the exception of this one that I said was okay for up to 6 months. The antidepressants that are used for their side effect profiles, you have to be a little bit more cautious about because there are significant potential adverse effects. These we aren't even going to talk about. They're so old and have so many side effects. And mostly the antihistamines that are available over the counter, there are actually not a whole lot of clinical studies saying they work, although patients do say they can fall asleep, but often are very tired in the morning. So let's go back to a sleepy patient. Now, Bill ended up with just literally insomnia. And the good news is, despite his kicking and screaming, he did almost all of those sleep hygiene things. It took him 6 weeks of hanging in there before all of this started to feel better to him. And he's now back to below that insomnia threshold, and having better coping mechanisms for if another stress occurs. But many patients come that have another sleep, one or more of the sleep problems. And this is where we're going to shift gears and talk mostly about sleep apnea. So snoring, this is universal. I don't know how many people have been on planes or long plane trips when you're just sitting there going, oh, please, won't somebody just wake this person up? But it's really part of a continuum of what they call sleep disordered breathing. So it starts with just snoring, and it can go all the way to somebody literally stopping breathing. So I'm going to, excuse me, I hope this doesn't, so snoring is, you know, but sleep apnea is somebody going, no breathe, no breathe, and then suddenly, and trying to, excuse me, that's sort of gross, but they try, you know, their body goes, you're not breathing, where's the oxygen, what's going on? So their body starts to get really aroused, they have to sort of half wake up and then sort of snort their way into a breath, and then it happens again. And the reason is because their upper airway collapses. So the classic person with sleep apnea is somebody with a large sort of floppy throat who tends to be overweight, have a big tongue, and when they're lying on their back, it falls back and obstructs the airway. And that's not good for health. So, and it's not good for the bed partner. They have done studies that bed partners of people who snore, let alone have sleep apnea, lose 1 to 2 hours of sleep a night. In fact, I was recently at a retreat center to do this wonderful meditation retreat, and you walk in, and we're all in a dorm, and guess what's on the bed is a pair of earplugs. Because their experience was that if you have a group of 6 people, there's going to be one of them who's snoring, and this poor person is going to keep everybody else up. So at night, we had this routine where we just sort of plugged in our earplugs because it's such a common problem. So let me just run you through a couple of definitions, because this is more important if you're a sleep specialist, but it might help you understand what they can tell on a sleep study. So apnea means a complete cessation of breathing. So that's when this person's literally completely obstructed, nothing's, no air's getting in. This is a strange thing called hypopnea, which means there's a little, the airflow is happening, but it's decreased. And as a result, you're not getting as much oxygen. And then there's this thing called AHI, and you don't need to remember this, but this is how when somebody does a sleep study and then they see all of these episodes, they add them up over a period of an hour. So less than 5 is considered normal. 5 to 15 is mild apnea. 15 to 29 is moderate. And more than 30 is severe. So the reason that they need to document this is, for instance, Medicare will not pay for the treatment, which I'm going to talk about in a second, if you don't have at least 15 per hour. So the whole purpose of the sleep study is make the clear diagnosis and document that there's enough airway obstruction that the person can qualify to get this treatment. So major treatments, before you even get to this one, which is I'm going to talk about in a second, CPAP, is to try and lose weight. They've done studies with obese people on autopsies, and actually people gain weight in their tongue as well as everywhere else. It makes the tongue, if it's already something that's going to obstruct the airways, even more likely to. Clearly not having alcohol or sedatives at night, because that just makes you comatose. Sleeping on your side or your stomach, you know, you've seen people sort of try and look at this guy's creative solution. He's taped with duct tape, you know, a couple of T-shirts on the back of his T-shirt so that if he rolls on his back where he's more likely going to snore, he'll have something that's kind of nudging him to turn onto his side or his stomach. Minimizing nasal congestion. If you can't breathe through your nose, you're going to probably be a mouth breather. And so there's actually a lot of products on the market. Dr. Clayman showed me this one, where people can literally rinse out their nasal passages and their sinuses, especially if they have allergies, to kind of keep these open so that their mouth is also, they're not just completely obstructed like that. Now, this is the major thing I'm going to talk about. It's called continuous positive airway pressure. I'm also going to briefly touch base about some mouth appliances and then finally just mention surgery. So these are mouth appliances, and what they do, these are pretty low tech, but they do need, you need to go to a dentist and you need to have one made for your jaw. But you can see here, when the person's lying on their back, right here is where the air comes in and everything's falling back and it's completely obstructed. If you can pull the jaw forward, that helps pull the tongue forward, And look, the airway is now open. So if you can wear this mouth guard, it really helps reposition the jaw, and that may be all you need. So this is CPAP. It looks kind of a little strange, but sure enough, people who benefit from this wouldn't go without it because it's has such a positive impact on the quality of their sleep. So they wear a mask or a little something that's going to help put air at a certain pressure through their nose, and that pressure helps keep that airway open. Does that make sense? So they're not going to collapse down and stop breathing. Unfortunately, this works as long as you wear the mask. It doesn't, you know, you're going to obstruct unless something other happens. But it can, when it's appropriately fitted, eliminate 90 to 100% of both snoring and sleep apnea episodes. But it takes a while getting used to. So you can imagine somebody gets sent home with this. They've got tubes coming out everywhere. They're already having trouble sleeping. Their bed partner's going, "You look strange." And so the compliance rate, what we call about how often people will continue to use this, is a problem. So there's a lot of education that needs to happen up front so that somebody gets through that first initial period and says, okay, I'm not a Martian after all. This is really helping me. And it's strange. Kids have sleep-disordered breathing as well, and we always just sort of go, oh, he's snoring. It's just his adenoids. But it can be a serious problem with kids, and 1 in 5 children under age 18 habitually snore. So if you've got a grandchild who's really, really doing that, it's not a bad idea to let their pediatrician know, because they respond really beautifully to having the same kind of treatment. So here's the long-term use I talked about. They all started using it. Yay, good, feel good. And look, the drop-off rate is pretty significant after 4 years, even though people almost always report feeling better. But look who are the people that are willing to hang in there. They're the ones with the worst symptoms. So that index of 30 means they have severe disease. So, and now the new machines are such that actually will keep track of whether or not the person's using it. So there's none of this, oh, I've been using it every day, when you go back, because there's a record, a computerized record of whether or not you actually wore your mask. But the nice part is when this first started, these machines were huge, they were loud, they were noisy. Dr. Klayman showed me the CPAP machine that's incredibly quiet that most people can do well with at home is about this big. It's less than the size of a football. So it's a really life-saving intervention for somebody who has this potentially serious problem. Now, if all of this doesn't work, if the CPAP doesn't work, the oral appliances don't work, you can actually go and have surgery. So you can either clean out, you know, if you've got problems with the nose. These are just really complicated procedures where they actually try and clean out and reduce all of this redundant tissue. You can actually even advance surgically the jaw. And then in horribly severe cases, you actually put a tracheostomy, and then you just hook the person up to breathing. But that's really unusual in these days and age. Okay, so let me move on. How many of you have had the experience where just as you're falling asleep, your leg goes? Have you ever had that? And you just go, whoa, what just happened? Did I run a marathon? Well, I wanted to tell you that that's a normal leg movement. That's a fancy name, hypnic myoclonus. They're called sleep starts. And just as you're falling asleep, it can happen. So that's not something you need to go to the sleep specialist for. But there are two other conditions that are a little bit rarer, but you may be familiar with. One of them is restless leg syndrome. Some of you may have seen some ads on TV for some new medications. That's this creepy, itchy, jumpy feeling in the leg as just you're trying to go to sleep. And nothing makes it, if you lie quietly, it gets worse. And if you move it, you feel better. So you can imagine that if that's what you're experiencing as you're trying to get to sleep, you're going to have trouble getting to sleep. And there's a new medication for that. But this is something different. The periodic limb movements of sleep happens not while you're going to sleep, but while you're asleep. And this is a strange thing where the person sort of periodically, their leg comes forward and their big toe goes up. And it's just like, oh. And it's in a pretty regular cycle. And you may or may not notice it, but your bed partner probably notices. Okay. This is a little bit more description of that. And there's actually a fair amount of crossover. People who have restless leg, a whole lot of them actually also have this periodic limb disorder. And here's some of the treatment. I don't want to spend a lot of time because these are prescription medications and these are not so common, but I do want you to know that if you have a sleep partner who's constantly kicking you, that you might want to have him or her at least mention it to their primary care doctor. So let me just give you a quick second case. This is a 20-year-old woman, and this is pretty rare but happens. Complains of incredible sleepiness at all times during the day, but particularly in class since age 16. She drinks a whole lot of caffeine. She's not had any other problems. And she, every once in a while, especially when she's laughing, she sort of collapses. And she's going, what is going on here? She sleeps fine, 8 hours a night. She doesn't snore, so she doesn't have sleep apnea. She wakes up refreshed from a nap. She doesn't have any medications or allergies. And she looks pretty normal, even though she's sleepy. It's narcolepsy. And I actually, one of my very, very best medical students about 6 years ago had narcolepsy. And fortunately, it had been diagnosed before medical school because it would have been a little bit bad to fall into a surgery if that had happened. And actually, he felt a danger of that if he weren't on the medication. So here are the diagnostic criteria. There's huge amounts of sleepiness. This is the strange thing that happened when she laughed. It's an abrupt and reversible loss of muscle tone with strong emotions, and also they experience sleep paralysis and a lot of hallucinations. And this is treated with stimulant medication. So I want to just finish up with circadian rhythm disorder. And certainly some of it's imposed on us if we're flying, 10 time zones east or west. That would be jet lag. And the poor, some nurses or some people who have shift work, let alone changing shift work. I remember the month I did in the emergency room was the worst month for my fatigue because they'd have us on days for 5 days, and then they'd have us on nights for 5 days, and then you were on the swing shift for 5 days. By the time you finished, you had no idea what time it was or where you should be. So how many of you do you know the larks versus owls? Have you heard that? So larks are people that are really alert and oriented in the morning, and owls are people that just start to come awake and are most alive at night. So I was an owl for a whole number of years, and like the best times of the day for me to be active were from like 11 till 2 in the morning. And I just, creative, open, awake. It doesn't fit so well with the rest of the world. Larks, on the other hand, are people that get up at 5 a.m. and feel terrific. But these are sort of, in an extreme case, there are people who have what are called advanced sleep phase or delayed sleep phase. These are people who sleep a normal 8 hours, but instead of going to bed like you and I, maybe at 10 or 11, they get sleepy at 6 in the night. So here they are falling asleep at 6, getting up at 1, totally happy, totally rested, but the rest of the world isn't quite in sync with them. So with all of these situations, some of the best treatment is to try and shift these people who have a normal cycle, but they're just off a little bit, with sunlight. So they have extra lights, and they slowly try and shift them so that they can get more in sync with the rest of the world. Okay, and I'm just going to finish with some things that are really unusual. So sleep, people really do the strangest things in their sleep. So some of it is sleepwalking, somnambulism. These usually happen in that deep, slow-wave sleep. And one family member I have, it just completely scared me. And he got up, and I was caring for him, and he's like, hello, completely awake. Looks like he's awake, but completely asleep. And usually there's a positive family history. The thing is that they can look like they're awake because they can maneuver around things, but there's a real danger of them falling or hurting themselves. And it usually occurs in childhood or adolescence, but look here. Kathy Lee's husband slept walk into the nanny's bed. So sometimes I wonder. And this last one is very rare, but still something important for people to know. And these are, remember I mentioned that when you're having REM sleep, your body is kind of paralyzed even though your eyes are moving? Well, these are people whose body is not paralyzed. So guess what happens? They're in the midst of fighting the dragon in their dream, and they're actually physically fighting the dragon. So this, the wife's woe, husband gives bedtime smacks. This poor woman, because he'd be acting out his dreams in bed, would sometimes actually, get hit. It's usually diagnosed in older men. And actually, in some cases, they think it's a pre-form of Parkinson's disease. And this you really do need one of those formal sleep studies to diagnose. And it's treated with benzodiazepine. But it's an unusual kind of thing. But it's called REM behavior disorder. I went on the internet and said, okay, what if I have insomnia and I don't want to take regular drugs? So let me just walk you through some of what's out there. So light therapy is a huge one in terms of shifting people's circadian rhythm. It's also really good if you suffer from what's something called seasonal affective disorder. I don't know about you, but I tend to get a little bit lower mood when it's winter and it's dark and I haven't had any sun exposure. So this is great for that. This I don't think I'm going to buy next week. It's a suit that completely keeps my body temperature the same. How do you like this? So you can either have music, you can have an iPod, you can have earplugs, but this is like go comatose. Now, this is very interesting. Some of you may remember I said if you get wakened in that deep place, you're going to probably have a little time, a grogginess. This watch will calculate when you're in a REM period, and if you program it for the hour or so around when you would normally get up, this watch will intentionally stimulate you at a time when you're in the most shallow sleep so that you'll wake up and feel refreshed and you won't get caught in one of those deeper sleeps. That's kind of interesting. This is really unusual. This is blue light therapy. So you put these, you charge up the mask, and there's some feeling that blue light changes melatonin secretion. These are great things. And this is something that will buzz you every time you get you start to snore. And it says, oh, it's just such a light little touch on the wrist. Well, it's aversion therapy. So, and they said, over the weeks, you will stop snoring. Well, I can imagine. So there's a whole bunch of very interesting things out there. And I'm sorry you can't see this because this is wrong, but there are now mattresses that cost, it's not $50,000, I checked their website, $60,000 for a mattress. This one is not going to follow sleep hygiene. This one will automatically adjust if you're snoring. It'll get you upright. It will check your brain waves. It will allow you to work on the internet. It will keep you warm. It will keep you cool. And this one isn't quite $50,000, but it's getting close. So there's a huge industry out there that's really trying to help people with sleep problems. So I just want to finish to say that these are important disorders. They're very common. Insomnia should just not be eliminated because it really has health consequences. It's often a sign of some other kind of illness. The sleep hygiene, I hate that term, but I think all of those behavior things, as difficult as they are incredibly effective. And really, if they help any of you or your family members, this lecture will have been worth it. I think using medications is really something you would not want to do until you'd really worked on the behavioral sorts of things. And I would strongly encourage any of you who think a family member or you have sleep apnea to talk to your physician about it, because that has a very effective treatment if possible. And also on your sheet is these resources. So, thank you. So, I know that was a huge amount of material, so I honor that I tried to give you just about everything, but I'm happy. First of all, did you learn anything new? Okay. And what kinds of questions can I help you with? Yes. Yeah, yawning. Boy, I knew I'd get a question. I don't know the actual answer, but people claim that it's when our oxygen level is low. So by yawning, you end up taking a deeper breath and you open your airways and it just gets your respiratory system moving. But I don't think anybody really knows. Yeah, back there. No. So it's a great question. So there's the whole area of sleep disorders that we've been talking about this whole hour and 15 minutes. But I wanted to give you the honest background that if people, not every older person who says, gee, I'm waking up three times a night, necessarily has a sleep problem. It may just be a reflection of the natural sort of change in which our sleep pattern occurs as we age. That said, if you do have problems and you're waking up sleepy, then some of these other strategies may help you at least optimize what you're stuck with when you get older. And each one of us has a very different pattern of sleep. Those are just average things. Does that make sense? Okay. Yes, yes. A lot of these studies, the question was, are there studies specifically of older patients? Absolutely. I didn't have time to review all of them, but because insomnia is across the lifestyle, life cycle complaint, it's particularly common in elderly people, and all of the medications and the medical issues that we develop as we get older tend to bring it out even more. So many, many of those studies and a whole bunch of the drug trials are on people who are older. Okay, good question. Is acupuncture helpful for this? There are no major studies of acupuncture for insomnia, but if you go to a traditional Chinese medicine practitioner who does the entire thing and not just symptom management, and you were having, you know, problems from pain keeping you awake or problems from anxiety, that person would try and address all of your symptoms. So it's conceivable that your sleep quality would increase. But there's no, you know, clear-cut trials where they've sent all the insomniacs to an acupuncturist and studied that. Yeah. Great question. So what about people who are light sleepers? And, you know, somebody in my family is an incredibly light sleeper, and we don't understand genetically what keeps us, you know, what everybody's sleep architecture is like. If they're light sleepers, but they can get back to sleep again and they feel refreshed, that's just who they are. And they may need to pay more attention to creating an environment at night that's going to not have so many noises or lights or disturbances. But light sleeping doesn't necessarily mean you are an insomniac. Does that make sense? Okay, yeah. Oh, great question. Do sleep patterns vary by culture? I think probably so. In the old days, when they went back and looked at diaries, there actually is a practice in some more traditional cultures where people, there's two periods of sleep. People would go to sleep for a couple of hours and then wake up for an hour or two, stay in bed, rest, or just get up and do very quiet things, and then go back to bed again. And I'm not sure what the value of that is, but that was described in a lot of the early sort of more traditional cultures. There's actually, it's called first sleep and second sleep. And we've, you know, now we so value staying asleep for the full 8 hours, it may be that that's a natural pattern for some people, but great question. He's asking me to comment on PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome. You can imagine, given what Bill went through, just with, you know, a less consistent, still a very important stress in his life. These are troops, particularly coming back, who do really, really well with a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy and a lot of attention. So there are ways, in the same ways that those associations got developed, there are some ways in which they can get undeveloped. But it's a huge sleep problem for returning vets who, you know, just get startled every time a noise happens. Yeah. Ooh, an opinion. How many of you, when the clocks went forward, had problems? Yeah. Oh, and I got up. I hate it in the spring because you lose an hour of sleep. I remember once when I was on call in the emergency room, I remember thinking, oh, my goodness, I'm on call the right night because I didn't have to come in for a whole hour because the clock had changed. You know, there's reasons for doing it. It was mostly for agricultural reasons, to allow people to have more sunlight during the time when they could harvest their crops. You know, there's energy uses and things like that. But even as little as an hour takes, most people believe that in general, in a community-based thing, it takes at least a week to adjust to an hour's shift. And you know, for any of you who've traveled to Europe or even just to the East Coast, 3 hours is a lot, you know, can also disrupt things substantially. So how many of you have also had night cramps? So this is an interesting situation. I mean, you can literally, if you're in one of those deep phases where you're tossing and turning, you can just, it's like getting a Charlie horse. That can be sort of normal. There are people, unfortunately, who have nocturnal leg cramps almost every night. And if that happens for you, it's important to just at least mention it to your physician, because sometimes it may mean things like your potassium is low because your muscles are too sensitive. You know, there are other things, but it's like getting a Charlie horse in your sleep. And unfortunately, one of the major drugs that we used to give for night cramps, which is quinine, you know, is off the market now. It used to be over the counter, and I don't know why it worked, but it was pretty effective, and I think it had some heart rhythm problems with it. So I have one patient who has very consistent night cramps, and he has just tonic water every night. It's not enough to get enough quinine, but but I mean, once you've ruled out that there's a problem with potassium or calcium or something, it is not that uncommon. And it's like you've just pulled your calf. It's okay. The question is, what about the light box, the fellow that was there? If you just, do you have a computer or somebody who can help you with a computer? Yeah, so Google, you know, light therapy, just light box. And there's a whole industry. They have special full spectrum lights. And some people just literally sit in front of them. There are some lamps that have full-spectrum light that will actually turn on slowly in the morning. Oh, what a night. Rather than have an alarm, can you imagine how... So dawn is coming up over your bed. No, I'm serious. Somebody, you know, and it just... The dusk goes away. And so... And it's the full-spectrum light. And that, so there are many, many... companies available to help with the light therapy. You just need to look online for that. Boy, specific advice about jet lag. You know, everybody says, you know, the melatonin works. What you're trying to do is get as close to the schedule you're going to be arriving at. And if you can change your sleep slowly, you know, the couple of nights before, that's somewhat helpful. The worst thing is you arrive at 3, you know, 10 in the morning, let's say, in Europe, you're exhausted, you really want to take that nap. If you can possibly not do that and stay awake until close to the bedtime at the new place, and you're going to be in better shape. I don't know how pilots do it. I take care of one United pilot, and I'm just, like, astounded that after 30 years he's walking and talking, because he's going over, I mean, he's flying to Asia every 3 or 4 times a month, and I just don't know how, because I don't make the transition very well. But it's mostly trying to get as quickly as possible on the schedule that you're at, and that may mean drooling as you're going through the hotel lobby and not trying to get on that take a nap, which will get you off. Yes, back there. So the menopause and sleep situation. Many of us who are in that situation. Feel that the sleep really, you get up 3 or 4 or 5 or in some cases 10 times a night with a hot flash. And that's certainly been my personal experience. There is some data that actually the menopause may be changing the sleep cycle in a way other than the hot flash. And so it's a little bit more complicated. But the strategy for that is, in general, wearing really light layered clothing, keeping the room a tiny bit cooler than you might normally, and having sort of lighter blankets so that if it does happen, you're not throwing, you know, the quilt off and then freezing because you've had a sweat and then throwing the quilt on again. So, and then certainly there are other treatments of menopause. But it looks like menopause and the hormonal changes may be doing other, affecting sleep in ways in addition to the fact that somebody's having a hot flash that certainly can wake them. Ooh, great question. I don't know that. The question was, is there any relationship between sleep apnea, disordered sleep breathing in children, and SIDS? I have no idea. I actually don't know. But thank you. I will research that before I talk about this again. Again, I'm an adult physician, but that's a great question. One more back there. You know, this, again, these are average community recommendations. If somebody literally, I mean, I'm sure there are people that can get by on that. There was one program I saw on one British soldier who literally didn't sleep. And they put him on watch, and there were, I mean, they put him in sleep centers. He was completely, totally fine. I don't know what was different about his circadian clock or his melatonin, but he had absolutely no fatigue and needed virtually no sleep. So there are some people, maybe, who aren't going to fall asleep in a lecture, you know, who can get by with 5 or 6 hours of sleep. This is, in general, most of us who are getting 5 or 6 hours of sleep. So the way to know if you really, if that's enough, is you go on vacation for 2 weeks, you have totally nothing planned in the morning, and you see how long you sleep when you're on vacation. And if you're not, if you're still getting up at 5 hours after sleep and feeling terrific, then you probably need 5 hours of sleep. That person doesn't need much more. But most of us, when we're on, the way to get out of really knowing what you do is be in a situation where you don't have an alarm, don't get up with an alarm, and just see in a two-week situation, if you have that luxury on vacation, to see what your body's natural sleep rhythm is. You know, the one of the best websites I put, if it's the National Sleep Foundation, and that's one of the first websites on there. If you Google sleep, you'll get a lot of those. But the National Sleep Foundation's great. In fact, this last week was Sleep Awareness Week. So I didn't plan this, but it was Sleep Awareness Week. So, and then they do that. They time it for when there's a change in the clock so that they can talk all about these things about, you know, sleep hygiene and how to compensate for losing an hour's worth of sleep. Anyway, I'll be happy to stay up here afterwards if you've got individual questions. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.